so this is April 7th, 2012, Belfast. We're still going a little off the screen.
Is the slide slanted?
The slide slanted, but at least I want to get everything on the screen. All right. So first we're going to understand what is worry. Then we're going to look at some principles behind worry, and then we're going to look at some solutions. So what is worry? When we're worrying about things, when we feel anxiety about something, we're thinking, am I going to have enough of this? What will happen with my relationship with this person? Am I making a good choice about this? Is it the right choice? Will there be some problem for somebody that I care about? What will happen with this thing? Will I get this thing? Right? Have I left anything out? Any other main categories that we worry about?
Health.
Health, okay. What will happen with my health? Am I going to get better? And they say the number one worry is we think we're going to run out of money before we run out of life.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good way to put it. And I've noticed that, not just statistically, but in dealing with people. It's the main thing people worry about. Am I going to run out of money before I run out of life? Now, when we say we're not going to worry, people might think, well, that just means I won't care about anything anymore. I'll just be callous. No. All right, well, I don't care if you get sick. I don't care if you fail your exams. It doesn't matter to me. Or just be irresponsible, like a very little child. Yeah. If we didn't worry anymore, we wouldn't take care of our health. We wouldn't take care of our finances. We wouldn't take care of our family. So many times we continue to worry because we think that these are the only alternatives. Now, there isn't just one book you can buy that would solve worrying, because then all of the dozens and dozens of books on the subject would go away and everybody would just buy one of them. There are so many books, so many courses, thank you so much, on how to live a life without worry. And of course, if you worry enough, then you go into stress, where there's all kinds of physical, mental, social problems. And we feel we have to worry about things. You know, the things I'm worrying about, they're all important things. My money, my children, my health, my career, where I'm going to live, how I'm getting along with my boss, and they're all uncertain. If I don't worry about them, you know, what's going to happen? And they're not going to work out. There's going to be all these terrible problems if I don't worry about them. So there is a way to face all of our uncertainties. And life is full of uncertainties without feeling anxiety. All right, to do that, first we're going to look at two principles. First principle is the source of what we need. We're going to kind of get to the root of what worry is all about. So we're going to do our diagnosis. So far we've looked at the symptoms. Now we're going to diagnose the problem. And then the end, we're going to give some suggested therapies. All right, so what do we worry about? We worry about what we're devoted to. Right? I don't usually worry about other people's things unless those other people are also part of my points of devotion. So I don't go around worrying about the kids and the finances and the health of strangers who don't impact my life. I worry about what I'm devoted to. And then I have to ask, all these things that I'm devoted to, is that really what I want the content of my life to be? Now, why are we devoted to stuff? And by stuff, I don't just mean physical things. We're thinking that our body, our mind, the people in our life, and our possessions, that they are essential. We talked about this a little bit yesterday, that they're essential to meeting my needs. Now, a need is something that if I don't get it, I suffer. I mean, obvious thing, if I don't get food and water and shelter, I have obvious physiological sufferings. But I also have sufferings if I don't get what I need emotionally and socially and psychologically, intellectually. So I worry about these things because I'm believing that they are the source of getting my needs met. I'm thinking, okay, I've got to worry about my body, because without my body, how am I going to fulfill all my desires? How am I going to exist? How am I going to live? Without my mind, how am I going to have satisfaction? Without the people in my life, without my family, my friends, my society, my country, how am I going to meet my needs for love and connection and security? Without my things, my physical shelter, my electronic gadgets, my clothes, my shoes, my kitchen utensils. You know, I was just reading a story about a family whose house was flooded in a hurricane. And they come back to their house and everything is ruined. Everything's covered with mud. They had to throw out pretty much everything in the house. And they're thinking, oh, a lot of this stuff, I can't even replace it. What will I do without it? How much I will suffer without these things. So we're not saying that those things are not important, but the problem is that all of these things we worry about are not really our protectors and maintainers. They're not really the source of getting our needs met. Obviously, we should take care of eating, clothes, and home, and job, and family, and community. But they shouldn't be the point of our devotion and shelter. They're not really what's meeting our needs. So we're thinking, you know, I'm going to lose a source of something that I really need. You know, if my wife isn't nice to me, I'll be miserable. If my body gets sick, I'll be miserable. If I lose my job, I'll be miserable. I'm looking at these are some of the human needs. We need truth. We need things that are authentic, that are real. We need security. Security both physiologically, psychologically. We need love, connection, community. We need to feel that we have meaning and value. We need a joy in our lives. We're joyful beings. And to be joyful, we need play and fun. Prabhupada says, freedom is a need of the soul. He says, the soul's need is to be free. We need a sense of individuality. So we worry about those things and those people and those conditions and those situations, which we believe are the source of these things. And we believe that if there was a disruption, if I lost my house, if I lost all my possessions, if none of my friends and family loved me anymore, you know, if I didn't have a job that I like, then I wouldn't have any of these things. Therefore, we worry about them. But the question is, can all these people, all these things, all these activities in my life, can they really provide what I lack? Is that we have a picture here of some plastic soldiers. And that's because in the Bhagavatam, all of these are compared to fallible soldiers. Soldiers that cannot actually give us the protection and the maintenance and the care that we want. Can they really provide it? I mean, if we think about it honestly, all these things that we're looking at in our life, are they really the source of the fulfillment of our needs? I mean, this is a big question. You know, we may think, well, if I have a nice husband, a nice wife, nice children, then they will complete me. But does that happen? Does that happen totally? Maybe to some extent, but not completely. It's not that we find absolute fulfillment in our work. Even if we're healthy and we have a nice house and we have enough money and we have a happy family, still, we have a sense of incompleteness if that's all that we have. And can they protect what I have? Is anyone capable of protecting what I have? Oh, is any family member, is any friend, is any country, is any structure, any possessions, any job, any hobby, is it really capable of giving me absolute protection? Or is it like a toy soldier that looks like it can do that, but can't really do that? So therefore the Bhagavatam says that all the things I'm worried about in this world, they're fallible soldiers. They may look good. It may look like, yes, family, friends, community, home, society, nation, career, healthy body, talents, knowledge, money, that all these things are, they look like they're going to protect what I have and provide for what I lack. But they can't do it absolutely. They can do it a little bit, sometimes to some extent temporarily, but that's all. Therefore, Prabhupada says, anxiety means that we're absorbed in something material. We're absorbed in something asat. Asat means it's temporary. Atmatattva means knowledge of the self. So because we're so worried about all these fallible soldiers, therefore we do not see the eternal. And we're putting our faith in something that's fallible and that's temporary. I know this for myself. I know I cannot give absolute protection and care and completeness to the people that I love. And nor can they do it for me. Here's a nice quote from Srila Prabhupada. With the source actually of our protection and maintenance, that really everything's coming from God. Even if my husband provides for me, his ability to provide for me is by the grace of God. If my house shelters me, the shelter my house gives me is by the grace of God. All of the elements of my house, where do they come from? They come from Krishna. The elements of my clothing, the ability of the people in my life to take care of me, my own ability, they all actually come from Krishna. And here Prabhupada is saying, don't worry. He's saying, just like the birds, they're getting their food. He's talking about these in a park. He's talking about the ducks in the park. They're finding their mates. They're getting their food. They're getting their shelter. So why won't I get what I need? Why won't I in the human life? Why won't Krishna provide for me? Right? The birds are given not only what they need as far as food and shelter, but they're also given intelligence. How to get what they need. Why won't Krishna give me that intelligence? So it says, nityo nityanam chaitanis chaitananam eko bahanam yo viradati kama, that among all the living entities there's one living entity who supplies everyone's desires. I mean, even an ordinary parent will take care of their children. Unless you have some very, criminal parent. But an ordinary parent, they're going to make sure that their children has food and clothing and education and even toys and friends and sporting activities. Parents are going to make sure their children have not only just the bare necessities for survival, but also facilities for their happiness and their development on all level. Again, even an ordinary parent, even a parent who's not, the best parent in the world. So what about Krishna, who's so much more qualified than some ordinary parent? And he's the actual provider. So actually Krishna is giving us so many things. Why do we worry he won't give us the details? And again, whoever we think we're getting them from, it's actually Krishna behind it. We may think it's my talents, it's my ability, it's my knowledge that's giving me my income. But who's giving me my talents, my ability, and my knowledge? We may think it's the company I work for that's supplying me. But who's giving them the wealth to supply me? Who's giving them the intelligence? And we see that any of these Any person that we have in our life, any talents, any abilities, any facility, any money, it can all be taken away in an instant. Which shows that it belongs to somebody else who's giving it to us. And we might think, well, can Krishna do it? And Prabhupada's saying, yes, he's God, he's everywhere, he's everything. He has the capacity. He's saying he's going to take care of us, and he actually has the capacity to do so. So that's the first principle. The first principle is that we're worrying about false shelters. We're worrying about fallible soldiers. And the real source of our provision and protection is different. Okay, then the next principle is dealing with the uncertainty factors. Looking at two aspects of worry. First of all, that we're depending on the wrong source for our shelter and maintenance. And second of all, this idea of wanting to control everything, wanting to get rid of uncertainty. So we may say, all right, I know Krishna can take care of me. I know God is capable of taking care of me. But I'm not sure if he will take care of me. Maybe he doesn't want to take care of me. So this is something you really learn when you make a big change in your life. And that is that our life is actually always uncertain. That there's no question that by worrying about things, by being in anxiety about things, or trying to manipulate things, that we can create certainty. Factually, our life is uncertain at every single moment. And sometimes we become very aware of that. If we suddenly find out that we or a friend of ours or a family member has a very serious disease, you know, if we suddenly lose our job, if there's some problem on a government level, if there's some sort of weather catastrophe, you know, then it becomes very obvious. Oh, life is very uncertain. But actually, it's always like that. You know, when you live in the same house day after day and have the same job day after day and see the same friends day after day, you might think, well, I'm in control. I put my shoes over here and they're still there when I want to get them. You know, I have a job that pays me a certain amount every month and that's how much money I'm going to have in the bank. But the reality is that akamala dala jala jivana talamala. Our life is like a little drop of water on the waxy surface of a lily leaf. You know, that at any moment things can fall off. At any moment. You know, how we project our life and say, this is how I'm going to have things in my life and this is what's going to happen. It's not the fact. So our principle is we don't stop worrying because we say, okay, I know that Krishna is going to take care of me exactly in the way that I want. But rather that I have some trust. I have trust that Krishna will take care of me. And I trust that the way he's going to take care of me is what's best for me. I have trust in Krishna. Instead of trusting myself, instead of trusting my family members, my friends, my government, my employer, my house, my clothes, my car, my electronics, whatever, I'm trusting Krishna. And I trust that he's going to meet all of my needs, my physiological needs, my psychological needs, my social needs, my mental needs, my emotional needs, everything. My spiritual needs, everything. That he's far, far, far more loving and caring than a mother with a little baby. Millions and millions and millions and millions of times more loving and caring. And that he's going to meet my needs in his own way, not necessarily how I think he should meet my needs. Even an ordinary mother, right? She knows how to meet her child's needs often better than the child does. And the child isn't always appreciative of how the mother is meeting his or her needs. And here is Krishna's promise, yoga kshema vaham yaham. Yoga means linking. So yoga means something that you don't have right now that you feel that you need. And kshema is sustenance or preservation or protection. So to carry what they lack, yoga, and preserve what they have, kshema. Faham yaham. Aham means I. that I will take care of you. So Krishna's taking care of everyone according to their karma. Yasvin Vigopa Matavendra Mahoswa Karma Bandhana Rupa Palambhajana Matanoti. But for one who's always thinking of Krishna with love, Krishna is making a personal effort to take care of such a person and make sure that whatever they have is preserved and whatever they lack is provided for. All right, so those are the basic principles. The principles are that the real source of everything I need is Krishna, not the things and the people and the situations that I worry about. And that Krishna can be trusted not only to take care of me, but to take care of me perfectly. All right, if I accept those principles, what do I do? How do I behave? How do I think? So I've analyzed these as four. And I'm sure that this is not the only way to analyze it. I'm sure it could be analyzed in more ways or different ways. And again, if you have any suggestion about how I could improve this, that would be lovely. So the first is, instead of being devoted to the temporary, instead of worrying about the temporary and the fallible, I have my devotion and my anxiety about the eternal and the secure. Now it's interesting, when you have anxiety about what's eternal and secure, that anxiety is another form of peace. That's the interesting thing about the spiritual. If you think, how can I satisfy Krishna? How can I realize myself? That kind of worry and that kind of anxiety brings one's peace and freedom. Then one can act without attachment to the results. And that's what one does. So the first one is one's inner mood. One's inner mood is devoted to what's eternal and secure. One then, what does one do? One acts without attachment to the results. When? At each moment. At each moment. One moment. One moment. One moment. And then one feels delight in whatever way Krishna chooses to meet our needs. And look at these one at a time. So first, being devoted to what's eternal and secure rather than what's temporary and fallible. So we already read that Krishna said, yoga kshema vaham yaham, that what you need I will give you, what you have I will preserve. And here he's saying, don't worry. Be free from all anxieties for gain and safety, and be established in the self, in the Atmavan. So what is the self? The self can never be harmed by anything. Our real self, the soul, is a spiritual being who is eternal. Nahanyate hanyamane shirire. If we put our thought on our real self, on our soul, then there's no anxieties for gain and safety, because we know we already have everything. We can't be harmed by anything. There's no question of ever being insecure or having any kind of lack. And Krishna says not just to meditate on the self, but to relish and rejoice in the self. Sanskrit terms used are atmarama, or atmarati, or atmatushta, to find satisfaction within, in the eternal spiritual self, that really has nothing to do with the fallible and shaky and insecure position of this world. And then whatever happens, I know I already have everything. I'm already secure. I can never die. I can never get sick. I can never get old. I can never be poor. I can never be without friends and without love. I can never be without a sense of individual fulfillment. All of these things are my own nature. And therefore, I don't need to get them from outside of myself. Now, one might think, well, if I meditate on the eternal and the secure, the real self, will I not then be callous to family members and friends? Quite the opposite, actually. I'll then deal with people with actual love from a position of freedom. When I'm dealing with people from a false sense of neediness, then I deal with people in an exploitive fashion. I'm thinking, I'm dealing with you to get something from you, to make myself complete. And when they don't give me what I think I need from them, I become afraid or I become angry. We were talking about this yesterday. I become frustrated. But if I know, if I'm experiencing that I already have everything that I need, then whatever love I'm giving to others, I'm giving as a voluntary expression out of freedom. And you might think, well, if I already have everything I need, why would I want to express love to anybody? Why wouldn't I just stay by myself, relishing myself, and the self as a part of Krishna? Because the self is full of love. The real self is full of love for Krishna, and Krishna includes all of the living beings. So if I'm really meditating on the self, and I'm really relishing the self, I will feel an ever-expanding outpouring of love that I therefore desire to share with everybody else. Just like if you came into a very large inheritance and you got more money than you could possibly spend in your life, you'd naturally want to share it with people. You wouldn't deal with people with the idea of getting money from them, right? If you feel you don't have enough money, then you may go to some people with the idea, well, you'll give me a job and you'll give me money, right? You go to some work and you'll be nice to the people at the job, not because you care about them, but because you're hoping, oh, they'll hire me and they'll pay me something. But if you already have plenty of money, then you're not going to deal with anybody with any agenda. And if you have much more than you need, you'd happily, willingly want to share it with others. So that is the mood of the spiritual. Then acting without attachment to results. So first one has to be devoted and set in the eternal and the real and the secure. And then one can act without attachment to results. Now one still has an attachment. Just like instead of being devoted to the temporary and the fallible, one still is devoted, but one is devoted to the eternal and the real and the secure. So here one is still attached to something, but one is attached to pleasing Krishna. While wrapped in worshiping the Lord, this word wrapped is very interesting. It's related to the word rapture or ecstasy or bliss, total absorption. So when one is absorbed, not just in the spiritual self, but the source of the spiritual self, Krishna, there's no need to worry about how I'm going to be maintained. Right? I'm not thinking, oh, I have to put all my energy just into being maintained. Then one is thinking, the real thing is whether or not Krishna is pleased. If externally I'm successful or externally I'm a failure, that's no longer my source of satisfaction. It's no longer what I'm depending on. It's not what defines me. Because as long as Krishna's pleased, that's actual success. So working with that attachment means I'm very enthusiastic. I'm enthusiastic to serve my husband, to take care of my wife, to take care of my children, to do a good job at my work. I do everything with great enthusiasm. Not because I think that I'm the source of the results of my work. Can any of us fully control the results of our work? Is that possible? No. So not because I'm thinking I'm going to control my work and I'm going to enjoy the results of my work. I'm thinking I'm offering this work to Krishna for his satisfaction. Whether externally it's a success or a failure is irrelevant. As long as Krishna is pleased with me, then that's the only thing I care about. Because he's maintaining me. It's not my work that's maintaining me. It's not my family that's maintaining me. It's not my government that's maintaining me. Krishna's maintaining me. So as long as he's pleased with me, why wouldn't he take care of me? And he's going to be pleased with my sincere effort to please him. So then I have trust in him. It's something like if you work for a really good company, you do your work for the company, and the company pays your salary. Now, if you do your best, then you're going to get paid. So if you're at a very good company, you don't worry about, am I going to get my check? You just focus on your job. So we focus on the service that Krishna's asked us to do, and we let him worry about maintaining. Not just maintaining us with food and shelter, but maintaining all of our psychological, social, everything. So this is a story about Magrari the hunter. Magrari literally means enemy of the animals. So So this Megrari, the hunter, he would half kill animals. He would shoot them in such a way that they would die very slowly. And the great sage Narada, seeing this, he said to the hunter, he said, if you insist on killing animals, at least kill them quickly so they won't suffer so much. And the hunter said, why should I do that? And Narada said, well, there's a law of karma, and whatever suffering you cause for the animals, you will also suffer in your next life. And Narada, by his mystic power, showed the hunter how he would suffer in his upcoming lives. At which point the hunter became very afraid and said, I want to be free of these sins. You know, what do I do? So Narada said, I will give you instruction, but first you need to break your bow. And Megrari said, if I break my bow, how will I live? So Prabhupada, in commenting on this, says that what we do for our income is not really the source of our maintenance. The real source of our maintenance is Krishna. What we do to maintain ourselves, and we have to do something to maintain ourselves, because that's the way the world is set up, but that's just our choice. Actually, everything we're being given is given by Krishna. Now, how do we do this? We do this by being absorbed in yoga in the immediate present. Actually, this concept of past, present, and future is part of material illusion. Spiritual reality is there's only the present. You notice that our worry is all future-oriented. What's going to happen in the future? But all we ever have is the present. Actually, the future never exists. There's never such a thing as the future. It's always the present. So the way we work without attachment, and the way that we become absorbed in the reality and the secure spiritual, is right now. Am I connecting with Krishna now? Am I pleasing Krishna now? Am I absorbed in the spiritual now? Now that may involve doing something that's future-oriented. It may be that today I buy a ticket for a trip a month from now. But my focus is on what I'm doing now. When I'm buying this ticket today, am I trying to please Krishna? Am I doing this as a service to Krishna? Am I dedicating everything to Krishna with remembrance that I'm an eternal spiritual being? That's the reality. There's really only the present and connecting with Krishna now. And if one does that, one is getting so much pleasure in the moment that the result, success or failure, become irrelevant. Fruit of work is I'm working hard now and I'm sacrificing now and putting energy into something now, hoping to enjoy something in the future. Krishna calls this fruit of work. Something like planting a tree. You go through a lot of trouble to till the ground and plant the tree, hoping that you're going to get some fruit. Now, when you're doing that, most of your time is engaged in hoping, and only a small amount of time is eating the fruit, correct? And then are you sure you're going to get the fruit? Why not? Maybe a bird will eat it. Maybe there'll be a late frost and all the flowers freeze, and there's no fruit. Maybe you go to eat the fruit and it's bitter. So you're working for an uncertain fruit. And then, even if it's a good fruit and you enjoy it, then you have to work again for the next fruit. And that kind of life is there's just small periods of enjoyment, uncertain enjoyment, with a life mostly of hoping and anxiety. Whereas if you're connecting to Krishna now and the fruit is irrelevant, the fruit is for Krishna. The fruit is irrelevant for my enjoyment. My enjoyment is that I'm connecting with Krishna now on the platform of the soul. When I live that life, then I'm having joy, as it says in the Gita, with a thrill at every moment. This is a nice poem by Longfellow. I act in the living present, heart within and God overhead. Bhaktivinoda Thakur very much liked this poem. All right. Well, suppose that Krishna provides for us in a way that doesn't make sense to us. Or suppose it doesn't look like he's providing for us. I mean, after all, terrible things happen to people. Their houses burn down, you know, a storm comes, they run out of money. Maybe terrible things have happened to me in my life or happened to people that I know. How can I understand that Krishna is taking care of me? So going back to the same slide. You know, little children do not always appreciate the way their parents take care of them. When mommy and daddy say, no, you can't have your candy right now, you have to have your dinner first, the children may become angry. When the mother takes away the toy fire truck that the child's using to hit his brother over the head with, the child may become very angry and say, mommy, I don't like you anymore, you're so mean. And the child doesn't understand that the parents are providing for them in a way far better than the child could provide for themselves. So Krishna also provides for us in a way far superior to anything we could do for ourselves, even when it appears that he's not providing. Even when it appears that he's taking something away, when the parents take away the fire truck, they're really actually providing the child with a way to meet their social needs, to learn how to deal with other people and get along with other people, which is a lot more important than the toy fire truck. So when Krishna appears to take things away from us or not give us the things that we think are essential, it's because he's really helping us to come to the absolute reality. And we can see even this world as the Lord's adventure. This is from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And he says this material world is also part of the Lord's pleasure pastimes. And if we surrender to the Lord in his sweet will and his pastimes, there may be apparent adversities. And he says here that if the soul actually decides to exalt in the pastimes of the Lord, then he will be happy. And if the soul instead takes shelter of illusion, then he will be miserable. And that's a question of our choice. We can choose to connect our lives with Krishna and then actually experience that Krishna is having an adventure that's including us in this life. And in adventures, there may be things that are apparently difficult. Just like people like to hear and read and watch stories of some adventure where the heroes get into difficulty and then they're saved. Doesn't everybody like stories like that? And that's Krishna's stories. When Krishna comes to the material world personally, what is he doing? There's a flood in Vrindavan and he saves everyone. There's, you know, monsters who attack his devotees and he saves everyone. There's all kinds of calamities from which he saves everyone. And that's fun. It's a story. It's an adventure. And if we choose to see our lives that way, if we choose to connect with Krishna and see our lives as part of Krishna's adventure, then we will find the difficulties in our lives are actually sources of happiness. And he uses this word, exaltation. We will find exaltation and joy even in the difficulties. It's how we choose to interpret our lives. Now, we're not saying here that we should interpret the difficulties in our lives as materially good things. Sometimes that's also true. You know, sometimes you lose a job just to get a better job someplace else. And sometimes the material difficulties actually open the way to materially nice things. But sometimes they don't. So we're not looking at things from that perspective. We're looking at things from the spiritual perspective. That once we're connected with Krishna, that however he deals with us is to bring us closer and closer to eternal joy and eternal security and satisfaction. And if we see it that way, this is how Krishna is dealing with me, to bring me into his adventure, then we see everything not as a source of material happiness, but everything as a source of spiritual joy. So we give up worrying not because I can control my future, but because I know that Krishna is supporting me, Krishna is giving me everything I need, and everything he's doing for me is for my spiritual good. So when I have spiritual devotion instead of material devotion, I have the opposite experience. I may have a similar life externally to somebody who has material devotion, but I'll be experiencing it very differently. As Krishna says, what's night for one is day for the other. And then I will have peace. If I know the person who's taking care of me is perfect, he's eternal, I'm eternal, I can never be hurt, and everything he does is for my spiritual good as part of his lila, then I will certainly have peace. And from peace I will have happiness. So thank you very much. We can have the lights on.
Thank you very much, Rumalakuma.
And
I got only half of it because I'm in the middle of doing some puja.
That's fine. Sorry. No problem. So if anyone has any, we can move this out of the way because it's kind of blocking things. If anyone has any questions or comments or discussions. Thank you for setting everything up. Oops, you just knocked over my water.
Oh my God, I was adding something else. Sorry.
Look at that. Watch out, you know, sit in the water over there.
Sorry.
Questions, comments, discussions? Suggestions, additions, subtractions?
One American writer wrote them as well.
Excuse
on
me?
This one American writer wrote on this subject as well.
Uh-huh.
He said, half of our life we spend worrying over the things which never happen.
Yes.
And if we only spend that time for Krishna, how happy we would be.
Yes. Worrying about things that we can't control, that never happen, that we can't influence their outcome by worrying. And if we took that same energy and used it instead, you know, how can I focus on my real self and Krishna right now? That same energy. Then we become peaceful and happy.
You mentioned in one of your slides that if someone doesn't have that thinking process of gaining attraction from friends, society, nation, and so forth, what he fulfills, you know, in finding his true self. But what I've noticed a lot of times is that a lot of people are attracted towards people who are going through that process, and they target them so they can share their problems with them.
Mm.
Yeah, and they in return become very disappointed if their problems are not resolved by that particular person who they see in some way higher, because he has found some way of resolving his problems.
Mm.
And sometimes also in return, it's difficult to express to the other person how to resolve problems because they may be so different from his. Mm-hmm. Or hers. So, from that perspective, yes, you can spend time towards yourself and finding your true self, but in some ways, to a certain extent, sometimes you will go through a thinking process that you're alienating yourself from society, avoiding people.
Not necessarily. I mean, if you're interested in a spiritual process, you're definitely going to lose interest in having your main intimate relationship be with people who are absorbed in temporary illusory things. But all of us associate more with people who support our goals than with people who are opposed to our goals. That's a general principle. You can't say that that is only true for people on a spiritual path. That's true, you know, even if you want to be a good golf player, if you want to get good grades in school. I was reading that half of people who go for a PhD don't get it because they never finish the thesis. In America, they call it ABD, all but dissertation. So I decided, well, I'm not going to be one of those people. So they were saying, well, what you have to do is you have to get a support group. Because one of the things that the professors do actively is they don't help you. You can ask them for help, but they never check up on you. How's it going? It's part of the culture. So over the summertime, I formed a little support group, and it was interesting. You know, I was working in education, and there was somebody else who was doing it. It was in English, someone else who was in nursing. We were all in different disciplines. But we would meet once a week just to share what progress we were making, even if we didn't understand the language of the other discipline or exactly how they were doing their thesis. And it made a huge difference. So if you want to accomplish anything, it really helps to be with other people who share your goals and who share your way of thinking. You know, if you want to graduate from school, if you just hang around with the people who are drinking and partying, you're probably not going to graduate. And one of my friends said to me, if you want to change something about your life, change who you hang out with. So this is just, you know, we don't want to say, well, it's just the religious people who are like that. But everybody's like that. Now, of course, if you're a spiritually minded person, that's not to say you don't have any friends who are interested in temporary material things. You may have family members and friends and co-workers who are not spiritually interested. But your core group of people is going to be people who support your goals. And without that, making spiritual progress is extremely difficult. Just like anything else, doing anything on your own without support is extremely difficult. And especially if you're around people who are actually opposed to what you're doing. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, yeah.
So, yes, it's definitely a fact. We're not going to hide the fact that if you become really interested in spiritual life, that most likely there are some relationships in your life that will suffer. It will be very, very difficult to keep all of your relationships with people. Most people who get deeply involved in spirituality end up finding that there are some friends that they just really can't be friends with anymore. That is a fact. Now, there may be some people who don't have that experience, but most people do. That there'll be some friends who'll just say, you know, we don't have anything in common anymore. Nothing I can do with you anymore. We don't have anything to talk about anymore. So that generally happens, but to say, I think that happens in many fields. I don't think it's just a question of spirituality.
Like before, when I
was anybody else? Seeing some of you here for the first time, I don't think I saw you here last night. Or
yeah, not last night. I'm kind of long, yeah.
Well, this is my first time here. So. Some of you were also here yesterday. Any other points or questions or doubts? Yes?
I just want somebody to talk, so I'll talk.
Well, we can't end if nobody else has any questions.
I had this question yesterday, but it's also linked to... this is a follow-on from yesterday as well. So it's about attachments and... You know, or getting rid of material attachments and develop attachment to Krishna, and it's a gradual thing. Sometimes, you mentioned maybe somebody might lose everything in the fire, all their possessions, or they may lose their family or friends. Mm. That's one thing, and that can be very painful and almost physical. But to be able to tolerate physical pain, is that even a higher level, like...
I think so.
With Haridas Thakur and Prahlad Maharaj.
Yes, I think so.
That they wouldn't even feel the physical pain because that must be very, very elevated, isn't it? So how can we...
Well, anybody, even a materialistic person, can be trained to not feel physical pain, at least temporarily. Srila Prabhupada talks about this in regard to Stalin, who certainly was not a spiritually elevated person. He wasn't even a materially elevated person. And he was scheduled for surgery, and he refused anesthesia So it's different reasons. Some people say he was afraid that he'd be killed if he was under anesthesia or whatever. But anyway, he refused anesthesia. And he was able to situate his mind in such a way that he had no pain. So I met actually a medical doctor who's allergic to anesthesia. And she found out about hypnosis in order to have some needed surgery without any kind of anesthesia. So when I read that Prabhupada said that, I became very intrigued. I read that when I was pregnant with my second child. And I decided that I was going to have a labor without pain through mental adjustment. So that's what I did. I went to a doctor who also practiced hypnosis in childbirth, and he taught me how to do it, and I was able to have a labor without pain. And it was a mechanical process where you basically detach your mind, and I focused my mind on we had the deities, they were Radha Govinda in New York, and I focused my mind on Govinda's belt. It was this big beads. And I just told myself, as long as I'm fixing my mind on Govinda's belt, then nothing with my body will disturb me. And I could feel what was happening in my body. I could actually feel, it was interesting. It was actually fascinating. What I realized is that when you're feeling pain or pleasure, you can't really understand what's happening. You're so overwhelmed with material pain or pleasure that you don't really understand things. But when you're detached, you can see things as they are. I could feel everything that was happening. But I didn't experience it as pain. I just experienced it as interest. Now, in order to do that, I had to practice a lot. I had to practice every day for months, and it took a lot of mental determination. And I could see that you couldn't mechanically do that and walk around life. It wasn't the kind of thing you could do and just sort of function in your life all the time. But the principle is still valid. And it's a valid principle that even a materialist could do. So certainly a beginning devotee could do it. Now, the great devotees are in that state, not mechanically, but out of love. So I'm sure we've also had experience of that, where, you know, if you're in love with somebody, things don't bother you. You know, when you're in love with somebody, you don't notice faults with that person, for example. You don't even notice them. You know, then after you're with them for a while, all of a sudden you notice, oh, they do this and do that. But, you know, when you're deeply in love, you're not even aware. And you may not even be aware of physical pain also. There's many examples like that. Many examples of people who, out of some deep attachment, they don't even feel physical pain till later when they're like, oh, yeah. You know, then they look, oh, I have a cut there, and they feel pain. So that can be done. But yes, physical pain, I'd say, is one of the most, if not the most difficult, because our greatest attachment is to our body.
And the time of death, I suppose the physical pain would be one of the most difficult things.
Well, often death happens because physical pain gets so great that the soul just can't stay in the body anymore. That's often why what impels us to leave the body. Just like even our little deaths in this life, the times when we make big changes in our life, we often do that because the situation gets so unbearable. I mean, how many times have we seen something that we needed to change and we didn't do it until things became just unbearable? And it's just like, okay, I'll change. I'll change. Whether it's a bad habit or whatever it is, you know, a way of dealing with people or a place that we really needed to move from or whatever. Now, death isn't always like that. Sometimes death just happens because the body just kind of is broken and it's not inhabitable anymore. Death is not always extreme physical pain. But I would say that the times in our life when we have strong physical pain, we should take as a practice for death. When there's physical pain, we really get, you know, our attachment to our body becomes very evident. And I haven't gotten very far in it. I've only got past the introduction, but there's a book I'm reading called The Body in Pain. and the author is focusing on war and torture, but the nature of physical pain and how in extreme pain we lose language, we start just making sounds without language, and how physical pain is, we're incapable of really communicating it to anybody else. If I'm seeing someone else in pain, I can't really relate to their pain. It's quite interesting. I find physical pain a very mysterious thing.
Sorry, what's the name of that book?
It's called The Body and Pain. I don't have my e-reader with me. It's upstairs. It's a book I found at Krishna Kshetrabhu's house. He's one of the spiritual masters in our movement. And then I got it on my e-reader, and I'm reading it very, very, very slowly. But I do find that physical pain is one of the most difficult and mysterious things to deal with in this world. That it's, you know, sometimes people will say, well, emotional pain is harder, but I respectfully disagree.
Given that a huge percentage of us will die of cancer, and you can suffer so much with pain from cancer that you can't actually focus on the holy name at the time of death, it could be worth checking out, yeah.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. You know, it's, I really feel, because I've had a lot of physical pain in my life, and I really feel that those times are a kind of practice quiz for the final exam. Because the chances are that our way of leaving the body is going to involve physical pain. So the chances of that are pretty high. Yet cancer is definitely a very painful disease.
Yeah, or if you take anaesthetic, you're just out for the count, aren't you? You're just morphined out, so you can't. Right. Yeah.
And then you lose your ability to think. Of course, in an advanced spiritual state, one is beyond the mind. One is beyond depending on the mind. And the ideal thing as far as death is to come to a point long before death where we're able to detach ourselves from the body and the mind.
Real impetus to chant and read and
yes.
Do devotion. The more advanced we are, then the less we'll suffer, and not necessarily.
You know, my godbrother Sridhar Maharaj, who had hepatitis C and then gradually got liver cancer, he used to quote a Buddhist saying that pain is inevitable and suffering is a choice. And when he would say that, I would think, you know, well, whatever. You know, get real. But it's actually true. Go ahead.
Does that depend on how you look at the pain then?
Pain comes from attachment. All pain comes from attachment. If I drive down the road and I see a car crash and I don't know the people, I won't feel any distress. But if it's my mother, I'm going to feel a lot of distress. Pain comes from attachment. And the reason that I feel physical pain in this body is due to attachment.
It's because there's some investment in
I have an pain. Yes, this body is the source of my, just what I was talking about. Of all of the people, circumstances, things that I am convinced are essential to get what I want and what I need, the body is right up there at the top. The body and the mind, the functioning of the mind and the functioning of the body. Far more than my attachment to my family and my friends and my country. You know, we consider it extraordinary if a person will sacrifice their body for the sake of family or country. It's an extraordinary thing to do. Because our body and our mind is our top attachment. You know, if I've got a broken body or a broken mind or both, then I can't fulfill any of my material desires or meet any of my needs as materially conceived. I might be able to, you know, meet my needs if I don't have a job or if my family all desert me or they all die or I run out of money or all the other things that I worry about. But if my body breaks...
Some of that's to do with the R complex, the part of the brain, the instinctive...
Part of it's like that, but it's mostly due to attachment. It's mostly due to illusion. So in a state of spiritual awareness, one will know that the body is injured and take care of it. I was able to know in labor what was happening. I could feel it. It wasn't that I couldn't feel it, but it didn't feel like pain. I could feel exactly what the muscles were. I could feel the womb pulling up. It was just fascinating. It's like, oh, wow, that's how it works. So you're aware of it. You know it, but it's just interesting. Mm-hmm. I was speaking to one devotee who had was born a natural mystic yogi and was saying pain is just energy in the body. If you perceive it as just energy, you don't feel that it's painful. And he has an ongoing chronic medical condition. And I say, you know, why don't you use your skills to get rid of it? He said, well, I really don't care. He said, it really just doesn't affect me.
Well, according to the karma philosophy, so if we have to suffer this pain, might as well suffer now than suffering in the next life.
Okay, but that's putting it in terms of suffering. So that's a different perspective. That's you're looking at it through a very different lens. So that's saying, okay, I'm materially conditioned, I'm attached to my body, and I'm suffering because of something I've done in the past. Let me accept this suffering willingly, you know, as the just payment, and wait for the mercy of the Lord. That's also true. Lord Brahma talks about that. He says if one does that, then just by doing that, one inherits the kingdom of God. But above that is you don't really experience it as suffering. You just don't. I remember I spoke to one other very advanced devotee in our movement who told me that he has constant physical pain. I said, how do you function? He said, I just don't put my consciousness there. Now you can only, you know, you can do that with a trick through hypnosis temporarily. But to live like that, you have to have your consciousness on the Supreme. You have to have your... Just like when Krishna was being held in the coils of Kaliya, all the residents of Vrindavan, it said that they had everything invested in Krishna. Whereas as a conditioned soul, where's my investment? You know, why is death so scary anyway? Because of death, I lose my identity of this life. And I've invested so many things in this life's identity. I've spent so much time and energy and money and care to get the knowledge that I have and the experience that I have and develop the relationships that I have and collect the stuff that I have and take care of the body that I have. And death means all that is gone. All my investment, everything I've been, you know, investing and investing. We used to have this drama of this man, all his life he's putting money in the bank, and then when he retires he goes to collect it, and they say, oh, you've been putting money into someone else's account. So it's like that. You know, I'm investing everything into what's called an upadhi, a false designation. So if I actually invest everything into the reality, that I'm not affected by the false thing. Anyway, I've experienced it enough to know that it's real. I can't say that I live there all the time. But I've experienced it enough to know that it's real. And that it's possible. And it's possible for anybody. And you don't have to say, well, it's only possible when I'm up there. It's actually possible for any of us now if we want it. Prabhupada says that the only way to get out of material illusion is to want to get out, to desire to get out. I've often thought that doing that is a much nicer experience in a tropical climate. When everyone's barefoot. You don't have to worry about stepping in the water with your socks. And then going outside in the cold. Okay, anybody else? Was that all right?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just to
yes?
I want to ask you one question. In Kali Yuga, I take it someone who aspires to get to a level in which they're finding their true self and following what you mentioned in the presentation, I take it the more they will face from people and pulling them down also. Will they face more problems when they're...
I don't think so.
No.
I think life for most people has its fair share of problems no matter what you do. I don't see that taking up spiritual life is going to add to your problems. It may give you somewhat different problems. It may change the nature of your problems somewhat. But I don't see that it adds to your problems. And as you mature in it, you definitely come to a point where you rise above problems. It really doesn't matter how many you have anymore. But I don't see that it gives you any more. I don't see that the average spiritual practitioner has more problems than the average materialistic person. Or particularly less or particularly more. It seems to be about the same. Now, that's very anecdotal. I haven't done a thorough scientific study on that. But I know a lot of people on the spiritual path, and I don't see that they have more difficulty. As far as more people trying to pull you down, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of envy in the world. If you try to do anything that's different, you're going to have some people who try to pull you down. I don't know what your experience is, but when I went to school, the other students and even the teacher would harass you if you were smart. Isn't that odd? You would think that in a school... of all places, in a school, the kids who were the smartest and worked the hardest and got the most grades would get the most support. That wasn't true in any school that I went to. The schools that I went to, you had to, you know, if you knew stuff, you had to hide it. If you were the kid who always had the answers, you know, everybody else would pick on you. So...
perhaps it's counteracted by the more detached you are, the less you care.
Exactly. It just doesn't, you know, it just doesn't matter so much. It is true that if you want to take up the spiritual path, that some people will test you.
Knowingly test you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
At least I had that experience in college when I was... in the process of joining the Hare Krishna movement. I hadn't like fully joined yet, but I was trying. And there were these girls who lived in the same dormitory that I was in. And they said, you know, now that you're 18, you should come see it. I don't know if you have them here. Do you have R-rated movies and PG and G? Do you have the same rating we have in America?
Similar,
okay. So they have movies where you can only go if you're an adult. You can't go if you're a child. So they said, you know, now you're going to be a legal adult. So you should come see one of these movies with us. And I said, but I'm trying to practice Krishna consciousness. I don't go to the movies anymore. And they kept harassing me. And they were nice girls. These girls, they weren't into drugs or alcohol or illicit relationships. And they were my friends. Actually, a couple of them were vegetarians. And they were generally very supportive of my taking up Krishna consciousness. So I thought, okay, I'll make them happy. You know, big deal. So I went with them to see these movies, which were horrible movies. I would periodically have nightmares about them for like the next 10 years. I'm really serious. I mean, they were so terrible. One of them was about an axe murderer. I mean, anyway, they were terrible movies. And they were never movies I would have chosen to see. Afterwards, it was three girls... afterwards, they lost all respect for me. It was really fascinating. Although they had pressured me, you know, for maybe a month, they had been pressuring me to do this. When I actually did it, then they no longer respected me. They said, oh, you're not really interested in spiritual life. So I'm so glad I had that experience, because by having that experience, after that, whenever anybody would pressure me to compromise on what I believed in, I wouldn't do it. Because I thought, okay, yeah, I'll do what you want, and then later on you'll just put it back in my face. So yes, I do think there are people like that. Definitely. You know, they're testing you. They want to see if you're real. They want to see if you're authentic. And you'll say, this is what I believe in, and this is what I do, and then they'll push it to see if you are who you say you are. I'd be very surprised if you never run into any people like that once you decide that you really want to take up the spiritual path. Well, thank you very much. And I'll be giving
you.
Yes, you have one more?
No problem. You were talking about living in the now, and it's something that I think a lot of people find very difficult. What's the secret, especially in the spiritual way of this?
Okay, well, let's see. Several secrets. One is trusting that Krishna is taking care of me. He's going to meet all of my needs. And I'm working with him. I'm in his plan. And I'm always going to be... It's a nice letter that Prabhupada writes to Jayapataka Maharaj. He says that knowing that I'm doing whatever I'm supposed to be doing. Whatever I'm doing is what I'm supposed to be doing. And that sounds really New Agey. But that's what Prabhupada said. And I find it very true. That if you're really working for Krishna and you're following the process, I'm always going to be where I'm supposed to be. So and in this letter, Prabhupada says to Jayapataka Swami, he says, surrender means whatever I'm doing is what I'm supposed to be doing, and I do it with great care and attention. It's letting go of this false idea that I can control my future, which I can't. It's just admitting it. I can't. My future is always uncertain, and I can't control it. So why bother about it? I mean, I can make some plan. Like right now, I'm corresponding with people about what we're going to do in May when we go to America, and where we're going to stay, and if someone's going to pick us up from the airport. But having been a traveler now for many, many, many years, I know that that doesn't always work. You know, so I'm making plans as part of my service today. That's my service today. When it comes down to it, that may not happen at all. Like my original plan, what is today? 7th? Okay, by my original plan, I was going to be flying to America today. And I had a ticket and everything. And then everything got changed. I wasn't even going to come to Ireland, and here I am. So, you know, I may make some plan for the future, but I, out of duty, that's what I'm supposed to do now, because if you wait till the last minute to buy airline tickets, they're 5 times as expensive and so forth and so on. But that's up to Krishna what happens. I don't even know if I'm going to be in this body then. I mean, how do I know? Anything could happen. So many things could happen. And you just let go of that. You do your duty now, today, which may involve some plan for the future. But I don't actually know what's going to happen. And I trust that whatever happens, that I will be where I'm supposed to be, and I'll be with the people I'm supposed to be with, and I'll be doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Because I've just seen that that's a fact. And then I offer this moment to Krishna. If I'm always worrying about what I'm going to do in the next moment, then I never connect with Krishna at all. And I'm always, well, I'll connect with Krishna then. Right now I'm going to do the preparations, and I'll connect with Krishna then. And then it's always up there, like the donkey going for the carrot. But yoga is, I'm connecting with Krishna now. How does Krishna want me to behave now? What would please him now? How can I deal with you and you and you and you here now in a way that Krishna will smile at me? Because this is all I have. I never have anything else but now. I can't change what's in the past. It's gone, as if it never existed, practically speaking. And the future never exists. There is no such thing as future. It just doesn't exist. All I ever have is right now. And you just think like that. And you start working like that, and you see how nice it is, and once you see how nice it is, you'll never go back to worrying about the future. Nobody could pay you to do it. You know, someone comes and says, you know, I'll give you 10 billion euros if you worry about the future and don't be absorbed in the now. You say, keep your money. Because it's freedom. And it's so sweet. It's what's real. Only the present is real. You're absorbed in something that's genuine and authentic. And if the mind goes to the future, And you just have some simple things. You know, Krishna will take care of all my needs. Everything Krishna does is wonderful. Things like that.
So the real persona doesn't have these worries, does it?
No, not at all.
It's the false persona.
Yes, exactly.
Dwells.
Good point. I was just, whenever you, just give me a sign, because then I will, I'm worried.
He's worried. That's because you missed the whole seminar.
I'm trying to be an illustration.
We're pretty much winding it. Okay. Yes, it's exactly. And you can have simple things you tell the mind, and after a while of practicing this, you don't have to do this much anymore. But in the beginning of practicing this, you have to tell the mind, like you said, first of all, the vast majority of things I worry about will never happen. You know, the chances that I'm going to be penniless and quadriplegic in the street with nobody to take care of me and in a war-torn country dying of cancer is very small. You know, all those things probably will not happen to me. Okay. And if it is what's going to happen to me, you know, if I am going to be paralyzed in physical pain with no food and no water and no friends lying on the street without a shelter, then there's nothing I can do about it anyway. If that's what's going to happen to me, first of all, that's probably not going to happen to me. And second of all, if that is what's going to happen, well, how am I going to stop that? I can't stop that. I can't stop there from being a war. I can't stop that. So, why bother? You know, you just take the absolute worst, take your worst fears, all our worst fears, put them all together, look at it and say, what's the chance that's going to happen? 1 in a billion. And if it does happen, I can't do anything about it anyway. So, let's just go on. You know, I have some responsibility. I have a responsibility to take care of my health. I have a responsibility to take care of whatever money Krishna gives me. I have a responsibility to take care of whatever things Krishna gives me. I have a responsibility to take nice care of the people that Krishna gives me in my life. But not because I think that I can control them in order to make something nice for myself. So if the mind goes to these things, you have these formulas and you just tell the mind that, and then after a while, the mind becomes accustomed to being in the now.
But before mind gets accustomed, we start resenting it when...
You start what?
We start resenting it when things don't happen our way. Say, okay,
no, it's very fast. No, it's very fast. You can train the mind very fast. A few days to a week. Utmost 21 days to form a new habit. So it's very quick.
Oh, that's
good. It's not something that's going to take you years or decades or lifetimes. If you become determined that I want to do this, you can do it. And at first your mind's going to give you a lot of resistance, and gradually your mind will accept it. And 3 weeks you're going to have the most. You can do it in a few days. But by 3 weeks your mind's going to be basically quiet about it, and you're going to have just rare times when you might, what about this? What about this? What about this? It's probably not going to happen. If it does happen, there's nothing I can do about it. Krishna's in control. He knows what he's doing. He's going to take care of me. Okay, be quiet. And it does. It really does. And then you may end up with some things that you're really, really, really attached to. And then you may need to go to a friend for some help. And say, you know, I've been able... And I don't know if I mentioned that yesterday. Where, you know, I think I did. That I was quite sick and someone didn't bring me medicine. Can I tell you that yesterday? And I called up a good friend of mine. And I was panicking. And my friend said, Armila, you've given up your attachment to so many things. Why can't you give up your attachment to this? And I went, oh, yeah. And what I did then, you know, my friend said, why don't you just, like, take a vow? I said, okay. I said, I'll take a vow that for the next 3 days, and I was quite sick. I said, for the next 3 days, I'm going to make no effort whatsoever to get this medicine. I'm just not going to do anything. Because it just wasn't happening. I was making all this effort and it just wasn't happening. And I was getting more and more and more anxiety. I said, I'm just going to let go. And it was like, whoosh. And I actually started to feel physically better because I wasn't worrying so much, which was interesting. Awesome. And since that time, I've never worried as much about health. And, I mean, take care of it, but don't worry about it. So there may be some times where there's certain attachments where you can't do it on your own. You have to go to somebody. And then they'll remind you, you can do this. You already did this. You let go of this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing. Why can't you let go of that thing?
But the problem is we are always afraid of dying. We don't realize that death has to come no matter what happens, whether you're taking the medicine or you're not taking the medicine.
Yes. Well, what are we afraid of dying? We're afraid of losing the false identity in which we have made a huge investment. Mm. That's basically why be afraid of dying. I mean, there isn't any such thing as death. There's no such thing as death. It's just moving from one room to another. You're just junking one car and getting another car. You're throwing out your clothes that have holes in them and getting clothes that don't have holes in them. So why is it so fearful? It's fearful because we're losing an identity. You know, I put a lot of time and energy into this Urmila Devi Dasi identity. And that's all going to be gone. And if I think that my false identity is something that I need, then I'm going to have a lot of fear. But if I just see it's just a game, even if Krishna wants me to take birth again, okay, then I get to play another role. I got to play this role for Krishna, then I'll get to play another role for Krishna. I wonder what role he'll have for me next time.
I was just thinking about, you might have seen these little leaves in the forest. They've got, at the end of the leaf, they've got one tiny little hook on them. It stops them from the wind from blowing them too far away from a region where they won't find the right soil. But it's like that with the false ego and taking birth on Earth. It only requires a tiny little hook to embed ourselves in the material world and all the ways that it is and everything.
That's right.
To get satisfaction from food and other people and stuff. But we go and make a big, steel anchor out of
yes, that's
as
right.
big as a house.
That's right. That's right. Actually, none of these things are hard to do. They're very hard to get up the courage to do them. But doing them is very easy.
If you only understand that in our Hinduism and in Vaishnavism, that there is no such a thing as death is not end of life, death is part of life.
Well, there actually isn't death.
No?
No, the soul don't die. Na hanyate hanyamane shirye.
Yeah.
So, what we call death is just moving from one body to another. I don't die. So, really, I'm not dying. I'm not being born. Na jayate miyate bhakadachi. Nayam bhutva bhavita bhana bhuya. Ajo nicha shasvato yam prano na hanyate hanyamane shirye. I continue to exist. I mean, even people who have what they call near-death experiences. You know, one of the things I'll say is, I realize I was dead, but I'm still me. I realize that, you know, I've gone through something called death, but I still exist and I'm still an individual. And many of them are very surprised by that. You know, how is it that, wait a minute. And sometimes, you know, they'll be hovering on top of their body. You know, maybe their body's on the operating table in the surgery, you know. And they're floating near the ceiling. And sometimes they look down and say, boy, that guy looks like he's in really bad shape. It's quite common. And then they'll say, oh, wait a minute. That's my body.
Okay, I'm ready for you.
So there isn't any such thing as death. But yeah, death is scary only if we're thinking that this identity is the means of my enjoyment. Okay, so I think now we're going to have prasadam.
That's right.
And we'll see you tomorrow night. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.